Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Robert Perry, editor of ConsortiumNews.com, who examines the role Russia has played in the 2016 U.S. election campaign and the danger of a post-election revival of the Cold War. Dr. John Guymon, professor emeritus of family medicine at the University of Washington, who assesses Obamacare's recent insurance rate increases and concludes that a Medicare for All system is the only long-term viable solution. And Anthony Rogers Wright of the group Environmental Action, who talks about the post-election challenges ahead for climate activists as they engage in fights to rein in expansion of the fossil fuel infrastructure across the U.S. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In April, King Willem-Alexander of the Netherlands opened the International Criminal Court's new headquarters near The Hague. It was a shining endorsement of the ICC's mission to prosecute war crimes and crimes against humanity. 6 months later, the International Court is on the defensive after three African nations, including South Africa, declared they are pulling out of the ICC. It's a sad irony after many African nations strongly endorsed the court created in the aftermath of the 1994 Rwanda genocide. Now, an increasing number of African governments are complaining about the ICC's strong focus on war crimes in Africa to the near exclusion of Asia, Europe, and the Middle East. Despite the rising criticism, the ICC retains support in the African Union from Nigeria and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Nine of the ICC's current investigations focus on Africa, and the court has also initiated inquiries into abuses in Gaza, Iraq, and Afghanistan. However, the ICC is seen by many as a creation of Western European powers, since Russia, China, and the U.S. never ratified the treaty that created the court. In early June, a train carrying fracked crude oil from the Bakken fields in North Dakota derailed and caught fire in rural Oregon. According to the news magazine In These Times, the incident helped reignite a debate over the role of railroads in expanding the dirty fossil fuel industry. For decades, railroads have transported oil and coal to energy-hungry markets. In the process, railroads eliminated routine freight deliveries, which isolated many rural communities. Trains transporting oil and coal have no set schedules, which has created worker safety concerns, as railway employees are now on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Yet in the first 3 months of 2016, the BNSF Railroad laid off 10% of its workforce due to slumping oil and coal shipments. The layoffs have led to a call to move toward a new model for railroads that proposes overhead rail electrification powered by renewable energy in conjunction with track modernization. Proponents of the plan say this infrastructure investment will bring the U.S. in line with high-speed rail service now common on public railroads in Europe, Asia, and elsewhere. For 35 years, Puerto Rican independence activist Oscar Lopez Rivera has sat in federal prison, convicted of seditious conspiracy for plotting against the United States, while involved in the underground group the Armed Forces of National Liberation, or FALN, which waged violent attacks in the 1970s. Now, Rivera's supporters are pressing President Barack Obama for a pardon before his term ends in January. Rivera's backers include Senator Bernie Sanders, Desmond Tutu, and former President Jimmy Carter. In 1999, then-President Bill Clinton offered clemency to 11 FALN activists, but Rivera rejected conditional release because two of his fellow activists would remain in prison. Rivera, who is now 72, is the last FALN activist still incarcerated. Before joining the FALN and while living in Chicago, Rivera founded an alternative school and a cultural center for Puerto Ricans. While in prison, Rivera rejected political violence and is now seen by some as the Mandela of Puerto Rico. In early October, thousands of activists rallied in front of the White House, calling for President Obama to issue clemency to Rivera, whose jail sentence runs until 2023. Thus far, Obama has been noncommittal on issuing Rivera clemency. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
As the U.S. presidential campaign counted down the final week before Election Day, accusations that Russia was engaged in an effort to manipulate the election results in favor of Donald Trump competed for attention with an 11th-hour vaguely worded letter issued by FBI Director James Comey. The letter addressed to Congress stated that investigators would be searching newly found emails linked with Hillary Clinton's aide Huma Abedin, found on her estranged husband, former Congressman Anthony Weiner's laptop computer. A subsequent letter from Director Comey stated the emails reviewed did not implicate Clinton in any wrongdoing. Just 4 days before the election, Newsweek magazine published an investigative piece titled, "Why Vladimir Putin's Russia is Backing Donald Trump." The article, written by Kurt Eichenwald, went beyond the long-running charges that Moscow hacked DNC and Clinton campaign emails, funneling them to WikiLeaks, and laid out a broader plot involving thousands of Russian hackers targeting the U.S. government, NGOs, as well as contacts between Trump staffers and Russian officials, and the Trump campaign circulating Kremlin disinformation. The article concluded that the Russian campaign is motivated not so much to support Trump as it was to hurt Hillary Clinton. Your reporter spoke with investigative journalist, author, and editor of ConsortiumNews.com, Robert Perry, who examines the role Russia has played in the 2016 U.S. election campaign and the concern by many that Hillary Clinton, now elected president, will ratchet up tensions with Vladimir Putin and Russia, triggering a dangerous new Cold War.
Once a foreign leader has been turned into some kind of monster by the mainstream American press and by the U.S. government and in different, you know, various other entities, that person is no longer someone who you can discuss in a rational way. We saw this, of course, in 2003 regarding Saddam Hussein in Iraq. The demonization of Saddam Hussein was so over the top that those of us who were questioning the merits of the U.S. government's assertions about his hiding WMD and his plans to use it against the American public, we were basically called Saddam apologists. We were discredited. So we've seen the problems you get from demonizing foreign leaders, and we're now in the midst of not just demonizing someone like Saddam Hussein, and think of all the horrible consequences that have come from the Iraq war, but now we're seeing the demonization of the president of Russia. And Russia still has a large nuclear arsenal, and we could be talking about the end of life on the planet as we sort of goofily go along and make fun of Putin for not wearing a shirt while riding a horse, or the different things that we've done to sort of make him into a laughingstock and some kind of evil force. There needs to be some restraint here. There needs to be some rationality. It doesn't mean that Saddam Hussein or Vladimir Putin are nice guys. They're not. But we have to keep it within the realm of reality. And if we end up with these efforts to create these monsters that we can then no longer talk about in ways that are within the bounds of reality, we not only are unfair to those countries involved, but we are unfair to ourselves, to the American public. We can get ourselves into wars because we get so excited and angry and just almost delusional about some of these people and their dangers they supposedly represent.
Robert, what kinds of concerns do you have that the ratcheting up of tensions with Russia that we've seen over this past campaign election year, that includes U.S. and Russian pilots playing chicken with fighter aircraft, we've seen the deployment of new weapons to Russia's western frontier, a new round of war games by NATO on Russia's border. We've also seen a plan go forward in the United States where $1 trillion is going to be dedicated to modernizing the U.S. nuclear weapons systems.
All this adds up to a possible new arms race and a brand new Cold War.
Well, that's what the American people should be focused on, I think, because whatever happens in the election on November 8th, if you're going to be spending all this money on the military-industrial complex, if you're going to be spending this money on wars overseas, that money's not going to be available for domestic infrastructure or for health care or for education or for dealing with environmental concerns. I'm not even sure if anyone's actually explained why we should be so concerned about Russia at this point. Even if they say, well, you know, that the situation in Ukraine, although the U.S. has a certain share of that responsibility, by the way, for provoking that crisis in 2014, but still, why should the United States start going into a nuclear war footing over which group of corrupt politicians gets to rule Ukraine? And we're getting ourselves into a very dangerous situation where, at minimum, we end up in conflicts that cost a huge amount of money and cause even more death and destruction, as we saw with Iraq. But we are playing games with the possibility of getting into a nuclear confrontation with Russia.
Robert, if indeed after the election tensions continue to escalate between the United States and Russia, there are millions of citizens in the United States that don't want to see a reignited Cold War with Russia. And I think for many of the Cold War years, many citizens felt helpless to stop that Cold War. But now, if it's going to begin again, what's the most effective thing people can do in this country to avert a new Cold War?
Well, I'm not exactly optimistic about that situation because official Washington is really controlled by people who want this Cold War to go on and to become bigger. Lots of money's at stake. Trillions of dollars are at stake. So it's always an uphill battle in that case. There's going to have to be someone, someone like Tulsi Gabbard, a very brave congresswoman, former veteran of the Iraq War from Hawaii. Someone like that will have to step forward and put their career on the line to challenge this war madness that we're starting to get into again. That seems to be the only reasonable route to put some brakes on this.
That was investigative journalist, author, and editor of ConsortiumNews.com, Robert Perry. Find more news and commentary on the dangers of deteriorating U.S.-Russian relations by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. One of many October surprises in the 2016 presidential election campaign came in the form of an announcement made by the Department of Health and Human Services on October 24th. That announcement forecast that the cost of health insurance under Obamacare is expected to rise an average of 22% in 2017. However, government officials cautioned that the predicted premium increases for the Affordable Care Act do not take into account the advanced premium tax credits or subsidies that reduce the cost for many people. But some families who make too much money to be eligible to receive the tax credits may find it difficult to pay the premium rate hikes. Premium increases aren't the only problem facing Obamacare, as insurance companies are withdrawing from the exchanges. The number of carriers will drop to 228 next year in the federal exchange in selected states, down from 298 in 2016. Some 21% of consumers returning to the exchanges will only have one carrier to choose from, though that insurer will likely offer multiple plan choices. Overall, insurers are raising prices and downsizing their presence in the ACA exchanges as they try to limit their profit losses due to the sicker-than-anticipated numbers of customers in the insurance risk pool. Your reporter spoke with Dr. John P. Guyman, Professor Emeritus of Family Medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle and a former president of the group Physicians for a National Health Program. Here, Dr. Guyman talks about the recent rise in health insurance premiums under Obamacare, reform proposals like the public option, and his view that moving toward a single-payer health care program, also known as Medicare for All, is the only sustainable solution for establishing an affordable, universal health care system.
We're 6.5 years into the Affordable Care Act, the ACA. There were never built-in rate controls on the insurers or price controls or cost containment in the whole healthcare system. So what's happening now is totally predictable and inevitable. The rate increases for 2017 are huge. The Obama administration is lowballing what actually is happening, is saying something like 25% average increase, but it's huge around the country in some places. All this as the insurers, which are more and more consolidated and four or five run the whole system now, most of the market share, are leaving markets where they can't make enough money for their CEOs or shareholders, even as their overhead and all is at least 20%. Compared, by the way, to about 2 or 3% for Medicare. And the private insurance industry, there are some 1,300 of them in the country. They're mostly for profit, and they are well situated in state capitals all around the country where they lobby and control and rotate their people into being, quote, regulators, end quote, of premiums.
Well, John Guymon, what is your prescription for either fixing Obamacare through the establishment of a public option that was one of the early additions that did not make it into the original Obamacare bill back in 2010? I know your group, where you passed president, Physicians for a National Health Program, looked to single-payer Medicare for All as the ultimate solution. But what about the public option? Could it be a viable fix for at least the short term?
The public option, yeah, it was dropped for political reasons back in 2009. The reasons I would give the public option why it won't work is, number one, the insurance industry, thanks to the ACA, has greatly consolidated over the last 6 years. The co-ops that were started as not-for-profit under the ACA have almost all failed already. There was an idea that if you set up high-risk pools, that might be a way to handle sicker people. That idea has been discredited over the years. But most importantly, I think the public option would be opposed as vehemently by the insurance industry as it would single-payer. And why fight a big fight to get a public option where it won't make much difference, and not fight for what will make a big difference in that single-payer national health insurance? So the public option would just be a Band-Aid. It wouldn't change anything. The ACA is fundamentally flawed. It's the common good versus the corporate oligarchy.
Dr. Guymon, what is the political prospects for a vote on Medicare for All, a single-payer program like most other industrialized nations across the world have?
Yep.
The insurance company in the United States, as you said, is extremely powerful. They spend millions of dollars on lobbying every year in the halls of Congress. There are a lot of politicians out there that would say Medicare for All or a single-payer program proposal is dead on arrival in a Congress, even if it were dominated by Democrats and not Republicans, as it is now.
If one starts with, we need the most efficient system for everyone in America that is sustainable and will work in terms of access and affordability, there's no question we have three choices. We can tweak the ACA with the public option, which won't work, and with increasing subsidies and maybe tax credits, et cetera, but that won't fix anything. Or if the Republicans get their way, they would repeal it. They've tried 56 times already. They'd repeal it and replace it with what? Well, they don't have a plan at all. So the third option is single-payer national health insurance. So we really need grassroots political will, and I think that is inevitable. That will increase as more and more Americans find that they can't afford health care, that they lose all kinds of choice. They lose their doc and their hospital because of changing networks. They can't afford care anymore, or even insurance, or if they have insurance, it won't cover their major costs if they get sick. We have alternatives. We don't have the political will yet.
That was Dr. John P. Guymon, Professor Emeritus of Family Medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine, and a former president of the group, Physicians for a National Health Program. find more perspectives on the problems facing Obamacare and possible solutions by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. While there were clear differences on climate issues between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, many climate activists were unhappy with both candidates. For some, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders was the gold standard on climate policy, calling, among other things, for an end to fracking and for a halt to the Dakota Access Pipeline, which is being built through unceded Sioux territory in North Dakota and viewed as a serious setback to reining in greenhouse gas emissions. While Donald Trump advocated for the full exploitation of all fossil fuels, including coal, oil, and gas, and said climate change itself was a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese, Hillary Clinton recognized the reality of climate change, but also supported less extreme exploitation of many of those same fuels. In particular, as Secretary of State, she promoted the global development of gas fracking and the export from the U.S., of liquefied natural gas. Clinton recently issued a statement on the fight over the Dakota Access Pipeline that famously, as climate activist Bill McKibben noted, said nothing. Given the current political environment, it's clear to those who favor keeping all fossil fuels in the ground that they have their work cut out for them. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Anthony Rogers Wright, Policy and Organizing Director with Environmental Action, one of the oldest environmental organizations in the U.S., founded in 1970. Here he described some of the post-election challenges ahead for climate activists and the many fights now being waged across the country to rein in the expansion of the fossil fuel infrastructure.
I think that one thing that people are going to be dealing with is continued expansion of fracking and frack gas infrastructure. I think that, unfortunately, during the election, both candidates demonstrated an affinity for fracking and frack gas infrastructure. And we have the science now that tells us that methane gas is 86 times more heat trapping than carbon dioxide, which, of course, is one of the many byproducts of coal. So it becomes feckless to say something like natural gas is a bridge fuel from coal.
Do you see any particular hotspots around the country where people are really fighting climate battles?
I'm happy to say that it's pretty much all over the country. I mean, and that is, if there is a silver lining to this climate crisis we find ourselves in, it's that we are seeing a call to action, and it's interracial and it's intergenerational, which is even more heartwarming for me to see young people really not waiting to be handed the baton, but are taking it right now because they understand that they're fighting for their future. They understand that they have to live on this planet well after people who are making fortuitous decisions right now. So, I think we're going to start seeing a big ramp up in Florida, where seismic testing is taking place in the Everglades right now for the fracking of oil. We have the Sable Trail pipeline, which is using eminent domain to rob people of their homes. And, there are some environmental justice issues, of course, in the three states that the Sable pipeline would be going through, which is Alabama, Georgia, and Florida. And then, of course, we're seeing the continuous amazing struggle of people in New York, the groups like Sane Energy Project and Vector AIM, and also in Massachusetts with the West Roxbury pipeline as well. I believe that we will continue to see native-led resistance against pipelines on their sovereign territory or proximate to their sovereign territory, especially as it pertains to water issues in the southwest part of the United States as well.
Anthony Rogers Wright, it seems like there's no lack of tactics to go after these various projects. From where you sit at Environmental Action, do you see an overview of ways that people have tried to resist these different projects?
The thing about these climate activists is that they are so prolific in their tactics, and which is a good thing because we obviously need a diversity of tactics. And you're seeing it everything from, of course, nonviolent, peaceful, direct action to divestment. I mean, the student divestment movement has been amazing. I'm proud to have gone to a boarding school, the George School in Newtown, Pennsylvania, which is a Quaker school, which was the first secondary school to divest from coal. You know, everything from direct action to hitting them in their pockets, we're seeing it all to, of course, petitions calling the White House and calling the next administration in terms of letting them know who climate activists and climate scientists would deem as acceptable and unacceptable choices for cabinet positions, you know, because this is the time of year, of course, where cabinet posts are being leaked out, the worst kept secrets in Washington as it pertains. And I think that what we're realizing is the intersectional element of addressing climate change. You know, everything from the Secretary of the Interior, who is going to have a very important role as it pertains to leasing the people's land to oil and gas infrastructure and oil and gas activities, all the way to the Secretary of the Treasury, who is also going to have implications in the financing of these projects, whether directly or indirectly. And one thing that I'm really, you know, excited about, and I think it's going to take this, I think that we are going to need an apartheid-era type of mobilization against the financial industries that are backing these operations and this infrastructure. And seeing that, once again, is extremely heartwarming. And we're going to have to up our efforts, of course, and it's going to be a combination of collective action as well as individual decisions. I mean, we know which banks are, for instance, financing the Dakota Access Pipeline. And so, yes, we can organize massive mobilizations against those financial institutions. But then it's going to take some individual choices for those of us who may be keeping our money in those banks. We have to ask ourselves if we're comfortable putting our money in a bank that is essentially using fees that they take from our bank accounts to finance infrastructure, which is tainting water, land, and air, and essentially actually committing an act of what I would refer to as slow violence, and in the case of North Dakota and in some parts of Florida, slow genocide.
That was Anthony Rogers Wright, Policy and Organizing Director with the group Environmental Action. Learn more about groups engaged in climate activism across the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.